Welcome to MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex. With me is James. Just before we get started on the podcast, we just wanted to make sure you check out our website, MacGuffinMen.com. Send us emails if you got anything to say, themacguffinmen@gmail.com, the MacGuffin Men, all one word, like the website. Follow us on Twitter, at themacguffinmen. Again, no underscores, nothing like that.
M-A-C.
Yes, yeah, that's a good point. And also, if you happen to enjoy our podcast and would like to give it a rating, feel free to go over to the iTunes store and give us a rating. We would like it if people listen to this.
And giving us a rating helps other people find it.
Exactly.
And more people listen to it.
Yeah. And I mean, we just got our first Facebook like from a person that neither of us knows, which is very exciting.
Not a spam bot.
Exactly. It means we're reaching somebody. So that's great. But yeah, anyways, and now let's start the episode.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. This episode is brought to you by Jumanji, the game for kids with oddly specific zoological-based home insurance. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, so what are we talking about here today, James? Well, I know what we're talking about, but I just want to tease the audience with what's coming up after our discussion. We're going to have a drunk Travis in the studio to talk about Men in Black 3, which he and I saw last night.
You thought you liked Travis?
Just wait for drunk Travis.
Just wait for drunk Travis.
But what are you and I going to be talking about here today, James?
You and I are going to be talking about Moonrise Kingdom.
Okay. That's good, because that's the movie we just saw. So.
Yes. Well, Wes Anderson's latest movie.
Yes.
And we've been kind of leaning pretty hard on Wes Anderson lately.
Yeah. But that's why we're not releasing this as our weekly podcast.
Yeah, but I think it's been a long time coming. I think we're both big fans of Wes Anderson, mm-hmm. and I think we're about a year and a half deep into this podcasting thing, so
yeah.
It's about time.
Yeah.
But yeah, this was his latest one. Mm-hmm. His follow-up to Fantastic Mr. Fox, I guess, was the one before this.
Yep.
And it's just out in Toronto now, or
cities,
so Toronto.
It opened in New York and LA on May 25th, today being June 1st, it opened in Toronto and a variety of other American cities, and like it opens in, you know, markets like Atlanta next week, so.
Atlanta.
Yeah. It's finally Ludacris will be able to see Moonrise Kingdom. But no, it's been, you know, just a limited release. And it broke records for, it had, I think, the highest per theater average in something as so few theaters on its opening weekend.
Yeah, like less than 1,000 theaters opening.
Something like that, yeah. And Brokeback Mountain's record, so.
But, good.
Yeah. And there were a lot of people in our theater, a lot of people in the show before us. The show we tried to see was sold out, so.
Yeah, and I was there almost an hour early.
So. Yeah. Which is, I can't remember the last time I was that early for a movie. I think it was The Dark Knight.
Yeah. A slightly different movie than a Wes Anderson film.
I haven't seen any theories that don't prove that Edward Norton and Moonrise Kingdom isn't the Joker. So.
How'd you like it?
I liked it. I generally liked it.
General?
Is that
like a 7?
I think a 7.5, because I feel like a Wes Anderson 7 has to be a 7.5, just because there are so many things that are just, like, you don't see anywhere else visually, and just some of the shots in this movie, man, crazy. Like, yep. What do you think my favorite part of this movie was?
I'm gonna go with cinematography.
Well, just, yeah, okay. The first 2 minutes specifically, the opening credits, as they're going through that house, it was so amazing, like, all of these shots, and it reminded me of, I don't know, I feel like me and my sister are probably the only people that ever saw this movie, but there was, like, this 1960s, or 1950, no, it's probably 60s, Disney version of Swiss Family Robinson movie. Did you ever see this?
Nope.
Okay, well,
you're on your own here.
Yeah, exactly. But it just sort of, like, all I remember about this movie, besides them having an odd obsession with sugarcane, is that they built this treehouse, and it was just the way the camera went through it, and it just always seemed like such a magical place. And even though the house that the family in Moonrise Kingdom is in, it's a house, but I mean, it's got a cooler design than most of your houses, you know, but it's still just the way the camera was just gliding through, and it was like, I don't know, it felt kind of magical, and it was like the Steve Zissou with the ship cut in half, but so much more elegant,
that's what it reminded me of right away. And I think watching Wes Anderson movies, and as we discussed in our strictly Wes Anderson podcast, he has a very distinct visual style, and a lot of things cross over from movie to movie, so watching this one, going into this one, I was kind of looking for those, you know, visual touchstones and those things that you get used to. And so this was one where it was the camera moving side to side, you know, going through the walls, moving horizontally from room to room. So right away, very reminiscent of that scene in Life Aquatic, where they're doing the, you know, the whole boat submarine shot.
And towards the end of the Darjeeling Limited, there's that great shot all of across the train cars. Yeah. Like, I mean, it's, you know, not, it's people from all different parts of the movie in this train.
Yeah.
It, like, doesn't exist in reality, but, you know, it's just cool.
Yeah, and it was, you know, it set the tone very early that this was going to be a Wes Anderson movie. Yeah. I mean, we knew this wasn't going to be a big departure. Even from the trailer, it kind of, again, had the colors and had some of the things that we're used to seeing.
Well, and he has an audience now, too. So it's like marketing. The marketing for every one of his movies from now on will be like that.
Yes.
At least, you know, as long as it's not marketable to another audience like Fantastic Mr. Fox was. Because, you know, we talked about how that was marketed as a kid's movie.
For kids, yeah. Did you...
Well, quick question. What did you... I said 7.5. What would you say?
Probably around there. Probably an 8. I'd want to see it again. Mm. But, yeah, probably an 8 without the 0.5 fluctuation for just Wes Anderson love.
Yeah.
No, I did like it. Just going back to the visual thing for a second, and I mentioned the yellow. The yellow was really prominent in the trailer.
Yeah.
And, you know, they leaned pretty hard on that just for the promotional stuff. That came through in the movie too, right?
Yeah. There was a lot of, like, that was one thing I kind of didn't like. But, I mean, it kind of made sense, but it just sort of, something about it didn't feel right. Because, like, the movie, there's a lot of, you know, kind of absurd things that happen. Like, he gets struck by lightning and pops up. And it's like a cartoon character. The movie, like, by the end, feels very much like a fairy tale. You sort of realize that they're kind of going for, like, a Wes Anderson does a fairy tale type of thing.
Yeah, especially near the end.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's where the majority of these things happen. Mm-hmm. But sort of, like, the color changing, there's one scene earlier on after the kids have run away, kids being Sam and Susie. It's just a very, it's sort of like the sun is setting. It's a very pink scene. But it's a very fake pink. Like, it really felt color corrected. And the blues later on when they're outside really stuck out. And the yellow was the least offensive to me.
Okay.
And I say offensive very loosely. It's not like I was like, oh, aghast. You know?
Yeah.
How dare they color correct this film?
Yeah, with, I mean, what you're talking about near the end, how it gets kind of fairy tale like, and I would say fantastical. I mean,
yes,
it does.
That's a good word.
It gets separated from reality pretty quickly. Oh, well, not pretty quickly, but pretty strongly near the end.
Not that Wes Anderson makes the most realistic of movies.
No, that's true. But as you said, I mean, it's the fairy tale aspect there is there for sure. And as I was saying earlier about, you know, seeing his other movies in this one, I thought the last, I guess, 20, 25 minutes, I saw a lot of Fantastic Mr. Fox showing up.
Yep.
The way that they had the masks on at the end. That scene where they're hanging off the building and it's kind of that still image and it's not moving. I don't know if it was the frame rate or what it was, but it wasn't moving to me visually the way that a movie, like a live action film does.
I actually think those are miniatures as they're hanging off the building.
I'm not sure exactly what it was, but it definitely, you know, wasn't the medium that we were going with.
It wasn't Bruce Willis.
Yeah. It wasn't what we were used to for the majority of the film. And, you know, it did. It felt very fairy tale near the end. And, you know, hand in hand with that, it felt very storybook and it felt very kind of animated and just illustrated at the end. And, you know, that does show it getting kind of deeper into fantasy, separating itself from reality. And I don't know, for me, I just thinking of, you know, how much of an auteur he is and the way, you know, his movies are very unique and interconnected in a lot of ways. I just saw Fantastic Mr. Fox and so much of the, like, the finishing sequence.
I totally agree. And I think he learned a lot from Fantastic Mr. Fox that he used in this movie, particularly
stuff you can work into a live action film.
And also this is his most kid-centric movie other than Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, almost as much about Ash as it ever was about Mr. Fox. But, other things. This is his first live action movie since Bottle Rocket that's shot in the 1.85 to 1 aspect ratio.
Okay.
So there's a lot, you get like a taller frame as opposed to a wider, more cinematic frame. And I thought that was really interesting. When the movie, I haven't seen the trailer for months. I assume I thought about it when I saw the trailer. But as the movie started, I was like, wow, this isn't 235. This is a, Wes is changing something, which is not something he does a lot.
Yeah.
And it was really cool the way it was used. You got a lot of shots in the lower third of the screen, like, you know, those shots, particularly of when Susie and Sam meet up for the first time. It's like they're the bottom third of the screen and then the rest is sky.
Yeah.
And I think, like, we talked about this a little bit with the Avengers. I think that was a lot of a height thing with all the trees and all the nature around.
Yeah.
And, like, Terrence Malick did a similar change from Thin Red Line and New World going to the Tree of Life, which was 185. But yeah, and I thought he used it really well, and it was sort of like Breaking Bad sort of uses the lower third very well in their cinematography as well. And I saw a lot of that in Moonrise Kingdom, and I really liked it. And I thought it was cool. It was a nice little change up.
Yeah, well, and not just for variety's sake, but I really think it speaks to, you know, thematically what's going on in the movie. This, mm-hmm. You know, as you said, this is a very kid-centric movie, not in the way that Fantastic Mr. Fox, well, I mean, that we kind of had a bit of debate about that, but it's not as though it's a kid's movie for kids, everything played at a level that, you know, an eight-year-old should get. This is a movie, I think, about kids for adults. You know, this is kind of something to reminisce about, something that, you know, people can look back on this and say, you know, maybe this is how I felt when I was a kid. And I think the way you're talking about this aspect ratio, doing so much stuff in the lower third, I think it's, you know, obviously I can't speak for him, but I got the feeling that this is, you know, this is a movie about kids inside this big world.
Yep.
And, you know, they're navigating this, literally navigating, you know, using maps and, you know, going from island to island, you know, finding their way through this geographical space in a very literal way.
Mm-hmm.
But they're small.
Yeah.
You know, it's about the world being so big and not necessarily about it being overwhelming, but about it being a very big place geographically and you're very small. And, you know, just thematically, I thought that worked really well for them to do so much in a small area of the frame when it was such a big frame. And, you know, just speaking to that, the issue of it being a, you know, a big world and small people trying to find their way in it.
Yeah, I like that. That's smart. That's cool. Another thing I just have to point out. Do not applaud at the end of a movie. This was not a festival screening.
Yeah.
Wes Anderson was not in the back desperately waiting for your reaction.
I'm split on that.
We were in a very, like, our audience was very pro Wes Anderson, unsurprisingly. Get a 10:40 show on opening night on a Friday. Like, it felt, there was a lot of laughter, I feel like, that was going on because people didn't want to be perceived as the type of person that missed laughing at a joke.
Yeah.
I feel like our theater was full of that because there was a lot more laughter than I thought the movie was deserved. But yeah, I just hate applause at the end of theaters and at the end of movies and theaters, and I will always bring this up.
Yeah, I don't ever start that, and I usually don't even.
I will never partake.
Partake, but
I partook for Drive when I knew Nicholas Winding Refn was in the audience. You know.
Yeah, I it's just. I don't know. I used to get really upset at that. I remember seeing the Star Wars re-release whenever. I clearly must have been young for that.
Well, yeah, it was like 96
people
or
applauding and me knowing that none of the actors, writers, directors, anybody involved with it was in there. And that seemed really goofy to me at the time. And it really is more audience-to-audience communication and just kind of how you guys all feel about it.
Exactly. And there was a lot of audience-to-audience communication going on tonight.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that in the annoying way. Yeah, we had a good audience, but
yeah.
Just saying as far as the laughter. Let's look at the actors that are new to the Wes Anderson aesthetic, because there are a lot of them.
Yeah, for someone who, you know, is kind of stuck to a relatively small group, adding a couple of new people in at a time, or at least in major roles.
Yeah, the only repeat people are Bill Murray and Jason Schwartzman, and they don't have big roles at all.
No, Jason Schwartzman, a few minutes of screen time.
Which he kills.
Yeah.
So good.
And Bill Murray.
Oh, they're still not listening.
And Bill Murray's in it for has a few minutes of screen time, but at least it covers almost the entire film.
Yeah, exactly. Know? Like, he's a key character to the movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, okay, let's, who is the new person you found the funniest? Or just most that you felt like fit the most.
When the trailers came out, and I just kind of looked this up on IMDb before I'd even seen this, Frances McDormand seemed like someone who should have been in the Wes Anderson world the whole time.
It's because she's a Coen person. That's why.
I guess that's what it is. Yeah. And
if you can make it in multiple like wildly different Coen movies, then you'll fit right in.
Yeah, and she's funny, and I don't know. There's something sweet about her to me.
Yeah. No, she's.
I can't quite put my finger on it, but there's something oddly real about her, and that totally fits in with this, you know, the Anderson thing.
I don't think she's she's never had a performance that I thought was like the greatest thing in the universe, but she is extremely versatile in a way that most actors aren't. I really liked Edward Norton. I thought it was really funny. Mm-hmm. I thought he fit really well. And I enjoyed it.
Yeah, and
he has that sort of boyish face too that really fits for Wes.
Yeah, he does. And we've kind of talked about, I guess we brought it up in the Avengers and stuff like that. I guess the kind of the reputation he's got in Hollywood and stuff.
Yep.
But separate from that, he does play a kind of a meek character really well. And he's got that boyish face, like you said. And yeah, I thought that worked. What up, Bruce Willis?
I liked him.
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't get very many lines to really stretch his legs.
Yeah.
But there were a couple of great things, like seeing him just sitting at a kitchen table with his legs crossed was funny to me.
Yeah.
And when he did get jokes, I thought he was really good. I would have liked to see him have more to do.
Yeah.
Just because I love Bruce Willis, and I really like when he's able to step out of the serious mode.
Yeah.
Because I think he's a really, really funny guy.
And he was playing against type. Even when things were going wrong for him, it wasn't, you know, him reacting in a John McClane, things are going wrong kind of way. It was a very, you know, I'm in over my head sort of way, you know?
Mm-hmm. Somebody, I would like to see Tilda Swinton in another Wes Anderson movie. Because she felt like she was better than the part she had.
Yeah. And better than 7 minutes of screen time.
Exactly. And like Frances McDormand, she can fit in anything.
Yeah.
I would really like to see her have a juicier, more Wes Anderson-y role.
Yeah. So. How'd you feel about the kids? And by the kids, I mean
Sam and Susie. Actually, I want to point out that one kid that has the speech in the treehouse, when he's like, "We failed, Sam."
Yeah.
That kid was awesome.
Yeah, that was good.
I thought the supporting kids in general were better than the lead kids.
Yeah.
I really didn't care for Sam. And Susie, I thought, had her moments. But
yeah, I feel like Sam was kind of, I think it was tough to cast. You know,
all of Wes Anderson's characters are
I just mean relative to, I think it was, let's not do Max Fisher.
Yep.
I think that's all it was. Let's do a smaller character, a smaller actor, someone who's not as confident and blasé. Like, let's kind of get, you know, not a coward or anything, but someone who's a little bit smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tough. I think if that's what they were going for, I think they did it well. He never really blew me away or anything, but I think it was just trying to do an anti-Schwartzman thing.
Yeah, see, I don't know. I don't know if I agree with that, because I feel like that character,
I feel like it very easily could have been Max Fisher.
Exactly. That's my point, basically, is that I feel like that kid's 12, I think, in the movie. Max Fisher's 15. I feel like in 3 years that kid is Max Fisher.
Yeah, I feel like the character easily could have gone that way on paper, and I think that the casting was a deliberate choice not to just do that again.
Yeah, okay, that's fair. I do think it really points out how lucky they were to find Max Fisher, or sorry, Jason Schwartzman back in 98, or whenever it was made, Rushmore was made.
All right, and Susie?
Yeah, I thought she was all right.
Yeah?
Yeah, didn't, you know. I wasn't like, she's not Elle Fanning in Super 8. I'm not going to be like that. But.
All right. So apart from them as actors, actresses in their performance, what'd you think of those characters, how they work together? It is a love story,
mm-hmm.
but we don't see a lot of love stories kind of this young.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. How did you like it? Did you think that they kind of, I think that there is an issue of trying to make it not overly sexual, but
yeah. I don't know. I didn't, and I'm the type of person that if you pull off a good young romance, it's really easy to get me.
Yeah.
Like, that's a thing I will just always enjoy. You know, like I love teen movies, all that stuff. And, I just, I don't know. Yeah, I thought it was fine, but just nothing really grabbed me.
Okay.
And you?
I liked it. I thought, and I think this was a deliberate choice again, but I think that Susie was much more sexualized than Sam.
Yes.
And I think that that kind of speaks to a lot of, you know, what Wes Anderson, again, not trying to speak for him, obviously I can't, but what he...
But that's what we're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. But what he shoots for. Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, this feeling of kind of being overwhelmed. And even if this girl is your age, you're kind of in over your head again. And I think that she was more sexualized, kind of like, you know, it's hard to sexualize a young boy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's easier to do it with a girl. You know, you can dress them more sexually, things like that. But I think that that is something, you know, it's a movie about young love and the writer, you know, director, Wes Anderson, is a male. So we're going to be, most of the time, coming from a male perspective. And I think that it comes through, she's kind of more sexualized, and it's intimidating. And I think it's supposed to be intimidating for Sam as a character. She's more sexualized. She seems to be further along, you know, in her puberty.
Yeah.
Developing more than Sam has at this point. And I think it just kind of speaks to that overwhelming nature, you know, things are, he's trying to keep up, you know, emotionally, I think he's there, but I think that they do a good job of him being just a bit behind physically. And, you know, he's young, doesn't have any facial hair. I mean, he's 12 years old. He's obviously not going to have a full beard or anything, but, he just looks very feminine. He's got kind of the light clothes on all the time. And, you know, you see her in a bra more, her saying like, you know, you can touch my chest and all this kind of stuff. Like, she seems to be pushing the physical stuff. And I think that, you know, I think that just kind of speaks to the, you know, more nervous nature of, you know, the male that Wes Anderson's trying to write for.
Okay, that's fair. All right, so, yeah, remember, like, when we had our Wes Anderson podcast, our full...
That brings me back.
Yeah, it was, you know, not too long ago. So check that out on our website or on iTunes if you missed it. And we sort of, or I suppose myself specifically, sort of really had a hard time putting, like, a finger on Wes Anderson as a person. Like, I felt like I know David Fincher as a person and Darren Aronofsky as a person better than I know Wes Anderson. And I feel like today... you know, I woke up knowing I was going to go see a Wes Anderson movie today. And that's not a feeling, like, for the first time. And that's not a feeling I get very often because, no, what is this, like, a sixth or seventh movie?
Seven.
And, okay, yeah, seventh movie. And, like, as we were sitting in the theater, like, I wasn't overly excited, you know? Like, I wasn't Batman excited. But, you know, I was, today was, like, a day I woke up, like, awesome. Today will be good. If the movie sucks, at least I will be seeing something that, you know, I'm just not going to see other times for the first time.
Yeah.
And it just, I feel like sitting in the theater sort of felt like just right. And I feel like maybe for people our age that seem to like Wes Anderson as much as they do, or maybe people a bit older and a bit younger who saw The Royal Tenenbaums and Rushmore at such like this key age, like 12 to 14, somewhere around there, which I think is where both of us saw those movies.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of like, it almost sort of feels like coming home in a way, like a movie going home, because his style doesn't change that much. As much as we talked about the fantastical elements that are here that weren't in his previous movies before Fantastic Mr. Fox, it's still very, very quickly a Wes Anderson movie right off the bat. Like, yep. He's not using the Futura font for everything anymore, but it's still there in everything that's not the titles. And I wonder if that's sort of the feeling that Wes Anderson is going for. Like, that's the feeling we get from his movies, and that's the feeling he's trying to get by making his movies, by going back to all those movies he watched when he was 12 and 14 and putting all of that stuff in these movies and all of this, these records and this music. And I thought that was kind of interesting, and I feel like that's the best analysis I can give on it. And it's sort of like why a lot of people maybe like Wes Anderson movies more than maybe even they should, just because it's like drinking a caffeinated beverage for the first time. And if you haven't had caffeine in a while, it's like Pepsi just tastes a little better because it's got caffeine in it. Like, I feel like I like Pepsi a little better than I would because of that caffeine.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of like, it's that taste of home that just sort of, you know, just feels right. And that's what Wes Anderson gets out of making his movies, I think. And that's what we get out of watching his movies. And I think that's really, really cool.
Yeah.
And not something directors do. You know?
Yeah. And I think that, as you said, you know, we come to expect certain things from Wes Anderson movies, and, you know, it's been a few years since Fantastic Mr. Fox, and before that a few years, there's been a few years in between everyone, and, you know, you come to expect certain things, and you want to go back to that, and this movie, more than, I think, anything, and any of his other movies, is about going back to things. All these movies are, you know, okay, he has a certain style, it's been a few years, okay, it's cool to live in that style again for, you know, disappear into that style for an hour and a half or 2 hours or something, to move back into that. But this is a movie about being a kid and, you know, about being very young, and it's regressive, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but it's very much about going back. And as you say, you know, we go back to these elements that we're used to seeing in his films, but this, we get that at the same time as going back to a certain time in our youth. And mm-hmm. I mean, I went to summer camp. I mean, you know, there are certain things in this movie I can relate to, but it, definitely not all of it.
Yeah.
But it's the sentimentality, the emotions and stuff like that. We're going back, you know, to our youth at the same time we're going back to these, you know, these stylistic elements we're used to in his movies at the same time.
Yeah, and this is the first Wes Anderson movie that's set definably in the past. It's set in 1965.
Yeah.
And that, by the way, is a time before Wes Anderson was born.
Yeah.
I was born in 69, I think. And he mentioned that he picked 1965 sort of because it was like one of the last periods before life could feel like a Norman Rockwell painting, is what he said. Like, it was sort of the last time where everything felt right. And of course, he's projecting this onto a time where he wasn't alive.
Of course.
And it's something I don't totally agree with, because, you know, there were world wars before that. But yeah, no, and he very specifically chose that time for that reason, because it felt like the last time before, you know, like, never-ending doubt crept in or something. And, you know, it's not a statement I agree with, but that's his reasoning.
Yeah, and one thing, again, like, about, we've talked about regression and going back, and we definitely touched on this in the Wes Anderson podcast that we did, like, musically, he goes back to, you know, the British invasion, Britpop, kind of 60s, 70s.
Not a lot of Britpop in this, but yeah.
Yeah, no, that's what I mean. Like, he always was about going back to that period of time in music, and we would say that, you know, he's kind of stuck in that period of his childhood, or, you know, we see his use of soundtrack, you know, the way that it's stuck at this certain time reflects on the way that a lot of his characters are stunted emotionally or in a state of rest development where, you know, they seem to be stuck and can't, you know, grow up, and they seem to be stuck at a certain point in their lives, the way that this, you know, his soundtrack choices are stuck at a certain time in pop music. And this one is before that. I mean, it's classical music, and it's kind of this modern record breaking it all down, but it's 1965, but we don't get the Beatles, we don't get the Stones the way we easily could have in 1965. We get, you know, this breakdown of a classical song, and, you know, it's kind of before his, you know, the way you're talking about, you know, the things kind of creeping up on you, it's before that. Like, it's very much not even coming of age, it's stuck at that pre-coming of age in this childhood state.
Yeah, and even the island is, like, removed from everything. So it's, you know, this is, the point is to have it kind of removed. And removed from pop culture, you know, like, that's the last place the Stones record would end up, you know?
Yeah, and you've said it's placed temporally for the first time. You know, it's 65, you know exactly when it is. But geographically, all these islands and stuff, they're going by Native American names and things like that. It's very, you know, not even pre-1960s, but pre-modern American civilization. Like, we've talked about all Wes Anderson movies kind of occupying the space and time before, you know, where it should, you know, in quotation, should be.
Yeah.
This is before all that. This is before Wes Anderson was even born. Like, this is very, very regressive and very, you know, juvenile, and that sounds like a terrible thing to say, but I really don't mean it that way. Like, you know, this is a movie about young love and about childhood and stuff like that, and I think that he's always had this sense of, you know, before adulthood, but this even puts it back, and I actually, not to make it an insult, but I think it's a positive thing. I think he does this very well to make this even before that, and really places things in a very kind of infantile childhood state.
Yep. The movie kind of, I think the movie ends well. Like, the very last scene is cool. Just him and his, I don't know a wife. and the movie turns out to be dedicated to Wes Anderson's girlfriend, which kind of makes it a little adorable. I don't know. It's a good movie.
Yes.
Yeah. And anybody listening that is a font person, if you can maybe settle a mini quasi debate, check out the TTC font next time you're on the subway. I'm pretty confident that's Futura, but we're not 100% sure. So Kevin or Kristen or maybe Zach, if you listen to this.
Or now that we have people we don't know who listen, yeah. Someone who we don't know, yeah, if exactly. You're into fonts, let us know.
So James will be back this week with myself. We're going to have a video podcast on Wednesday. I think it's about Apatow movies. And Thursday, we will be in argument about Fight Club. So
the most
contentious. We've recorded it already.
The most contentious podcast.
Yeah, we already know neither of us stabbed each other, but it gets a little contentious. So
if you've been waiting for Alex and I not to get along, this is the podcast for you.
It's like American Beauty times two. It gets pretty intense. Let's get drunk Travis in here. Drunk Travis.
Travis.
Drunk Travis, it's your time. As much as you want.
All right.
Don't do too much, I suppose.
All right. Are we on?
Yeah, we're on.
All right.
We've got Drone.
Oh,
Drunk
my God,
Travis.
It was so bad.
Drunk Travis in the studio. Let's talk about Men in Black 3. How'd you feel about it?
The audience was very loud.
Yeah. Well, we had...
Let's talk about loud movies.
We had a couple of really drunk people in the front.
We did, and unfortunately, I was not one of them at the time. I wish. I think I would have enjoyed it more if that was the case.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
Do
some setup.
So we both saw Men in Black 3. If you've seen the trailer, that's enough setup. It looks like shit. We saw it anyways. And turns out it was shit. But maybe you could give me sort of the rundown that you gave. About 20 minutes into the movie, Travis taps me on the shoulder and drops some... extremely correct knowledge. And what did you say?
All right, all the dialogue, they're just explaining plot points to each other loudly. That's all the dialogue was. There was no character development. There was no anything else. There was just the rules of time travel and what was happening.
And over and over. Agent J. Will Smith would say something to O, who's Emma Thompson. He's like, I got to go back in time to... kill Jermaine Clement and get Tommy Lee Jones and save him. And then Emma Thompson's you have to go back in time.
I agree. Here are some supporting reasons. You have to go back in time. But even though I'm a fantastic actress, I will not be in the movie doing very much.
Yeah, exactly.
Good luck, Agent Shea.
I will be replaced by Alice Eve when you go back.
But not even Alice Eve for very long.
No. But with really weird hair. And it was just it was just a movie that just existed, right?
It was a paycheck movie.
Yeah, exactly. And it was just sort of I don't know, Sony was like, well, we could do Men in Black 3. And then everybody was like, yeah. And then they did. And that's what it was.
Jermaine Clement gave 110%.
Yes, he did.
And he was absolutely, earnest and every bit. That was his, okay, I'm going to show up and be an actor in this type of movie. Yeah. And I'm going to fucking be a professional. And he was. And it was amazing.
I think my favorite part of the movie is when... And I know, because...
Spoilers.
It doesn't matter.
Okay.
Nobody is going to watch this movie.
No. People did watch it. It overtook the Avengers.
Yes, that's true. After 3 weeks, something had to eventually.
It was low-hanging fruit.
Okay, yeah. My favorite part of the movie has to be when present or future Jermaine Clement travels back in time.
I couldn't tell which was which. He was playing
one had
Orson.
Only one arm.
He was playing Orson Welles meets Ghost Rider.
Meets Benicio del Toro.
For the whole movie.
Yeah.
And it was amazing.
But my favorite scene, and I know you liked it as well, is when he kicks open the door to see his past self, and they instantly...
Here is why you would fail! I have some facts to recite to you.
And then he recites the facts!
Yeah.
It was so bad!
Oh. That was my favorite scene in the movie, though.
And they were, circling around each other, yelling facts at each other.
They were standing in place, and they were shouting at each other in the same volume, and they both looked the same. They didn't age, so they were the same. They were just wearing different clothes. So the two copies of Jermaine Clement as this character, as Orson Welles' Ghost Rider, shouting at each other in the same voice. And it was funny. It was really funny. The only deliberately funny part of the movie that was, and it was funny, but it was so long that it didn't, it didn't end, and they were just shouting what had happened.
Why
the plan would succeed or why the plan maybe wouldn't succeed.
Yeah. Over and over again. There were a couple of other things that were legitimately funny. There were some good Tommy Lee Jones moments.
Josh Brolin's impression of Tommy Lee Jones was good.
And Bill Hader had some moments as Eddie Warhol. I thought that was funny.
I think my favorite other scene
And Michael Stuhlbarg was really good. I thought he was great. I never know how to say his name, but the guy from Hugo and A Serious Man, he's on Boardwalk Empire.
Who was he in?
Men in Black. I Touch You, You See the Mets Win the World Series. It was a stupid character, but he was really good.
But he was a walking plot device.
Yeah, no, everybody was a walking plot device. That's true.
I guess there's no. I don't know. Jamaica Man was good. I think my favorite other scene was Tommy Lee Jones in his previously unseen apartment with old bookcase, old lamp, whiskey. And secret cabinet of Men in Black guns.
Yeah,
I think that could have been the trailer, and I would if it was just him sitting there drinking, calling Jay to apologize, and then walking into his secret gun cabinet.
Men in Black 3.
Yeah, that would have been the best teaser you could have possibly given me.
Yeah. It could. Yeah, might as well have been. We saw Men in Black 3, so you don't have to.
Is this a new regular thing where are you going to drag me to shitty movies?
No. You
this summer.
Remember, you sent the email saying, "Are you going to see Men in Black 3?" Prove it. And then I said, "I have the email. I will post the email under this podcast."
Don't do it.
Yeah, I'm going to do that. Thank you for listening, or not.
We will see crappy movies all summer, so you don't have to.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you for stopping by, except for That's My Boy, the new Adam Sandler movie. Jimmy's seen that one.
If you don't want to see Kung Fu Panda 3, we might see it in an afternoon and over drinks.
So thank you for stopping by, Drunk Travis, and be sure to stay tuned to The MacGuffin Man. Check out our website, themacguffinman.com, and we'll see you soon.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com, or follow us on Twitter @themacguffinmen.